Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome each of you to our 2017 annual client education event. To start us off this morning, we are going to have Jolene Searles, who will be giving us an update on some of the changes that have occurred at the Anderson firm since our last client education call. Jolene is a senior attorney with the firm, and she is also the firm's managing partner. She is the director of operations for both our West Florida and our Tennessee markets, as well as the director of our high net worth planning division. So, Jolene, I will now turn it over to you to tell everyone what's new at the Anderson firm.
Thanks so much, Rhonda. Hello, everyone, and thank you all for joining us today. This is our opportunity to share with you what's new with us and what new and interesting developments have been happening out there in the world that may impact you and the work that we've done together. As many of you know, it's been a whirlwind of a year for us at the Anderson firm this past year. Our beloved founder, Bill Anderson, passed away in October. Many of you know Bill, and you'll remember him as a brilliant attorney, a loving father, a great friend, an incredible partner, a fantastic mentor, a charismatic speaker, and just an overall great guy who was larger than life. Most people could strive for several lifetimes to accomplish what Bill did in one. He was just incredible. We'll miss him dearly, but his legacy will and is living on. We always preach to our clients that have businesses the importance of having a good business succession plan in place. Well, Bill was the perfect example of that. He made sure that everything was in place for the firm to continue after he was gone. From the birth of the Anderson firm until Bill passed, he handpicked the best of the best team members to work with him and to work with his clients who were so, so important to him. Because he built such a strong team, we allowed for the firm not only to continue moving forward, but to keep improving. When Bill passed, we didn't lose one single team member. And over the past 8 months, we've continued on that path, and we're now even stronger than we were before. We still have the same goal for each of our clients to receive the ultimate client experience, and we truly hope that each and every one of you feel that you have. Even though Bill was the face of the firm, and many of you may have worked with Bill, we've always taken a team approach to everything that we've done. So whether you've worked with Bill, whether you've worked with me, whether you've worked with Aaron or anyone else at the firm, you probably know that there have been multiple other team members involved with your plan. So if you called in with a question, you may have been talking to Angela or talking to Will, who were able to answer your question because they worked on your plan as well. So just remember that we're always here to help you. Anytime you have questions or need assistance, just let us know. Will Anderson has stepped into the very large shoes of his father, and he is running our New York office. For those of you who haven't had the chance to work with Will, you are in for a treat. He's probably one of the longest team members we've had, starting his employment with the firm at age 3, playing with blocks on the floor of the firm that his parents built. He's moved from firm mascot to intern to law clerk to where he is now, and we couldn't be happier to have him running our New York office. We also have a couple other exciting changes at the firm. We have moved our West Florida office to the Sarasota City Center in downtown Sarasota, and we've also moved our New York office to 5 Penn Plaza. We think both new locations are definitely an improvement and also are more convenient for a lot of our clients. Within the past year, we brought in Sean Shepard as a partner to run our litigation department. Sean's been working of counsel with the firm for actually longer than I've even been with the firm, for well over a decade. And we all decided it was time to take the next step in our relationship, and we couldn't be happier to have him as a partner. He is a brilliant attorney. His areas of expertise allow us to expand the areas in which we're able to assist our clients. And in just a bit, Sean's going to elaborate more on some of those new areas. We've also revamped our website, and I encourage all of you to visit the new page and let us know what you think. I hope that you'll like it as much as we do. And in just a second, I'm going to turn you over to Angela Hooper, formerly Angela Christian, to tell you a little bit more about it. Angela has also been with the firm for over a decade. She is our Director of Client Services and Professional Alliances. She helps clients navigate through the funding and updating process that comes after your trust is put into place. She's also here to assist with the day-to-day questions that many of you may have after setting up your plan, whether it's just calling in to ask who your backup trustee is or calling in because you think you might want to make a small change to your documents, whatever it may be, Angela will either be able to help you or she will get you to the person who can. So with no further ado, I am going to let Angela tell you about this website that she has put so much time and energy into redesigning. Angela?
Thank you, Jolene. That was so nice of you to say all that. Good morning, everyone. I have to tell you, I am pleased to tell you about our new website, which officially launched this morning. So you all are the very first to know about this. As you know, when clients come to us with a small change to their revocable trust, we create what's called an amendment. And when clients have many changes to their trust documents, or they've already made several amendments to those documents, we likely recommend a restatement, which is basically a rewrite of the entire trust. And essentially, that is what we have done with our website, is we have restated our website. And this means, like, when you restate your estate plan, that the title of your estate plan remains exactly the same. Our website address has remained exactly the same. It's www.theandersonfirm.com. Now, if you pull up our website and you are not seeing something new, you're still seeing something old, if you'll hit Control F5, that should reload the page for you and not pull it from your memory so that you would be able to see the new version. The new website provides a clear message about who we are, what we do, and how the areas we practice in can provide peace of mind for you and your family. And the goal with the new website is to provide web visitors an easier way to learn about the Anderson Firm and the services and solutions that are available through estate planning, estate settlement and probate, asset protection, litigation, and real estate. And on the new website, you're going to find up-to-date information on the firm and on our team. You're going to find information about the areas in which we practice. You're going to find more information on our resources page for prospective clients, current clients, and financial advisors. And most importantly, we now have the ability to update and maintain our website. So that means the information there will remain up to date, and current news and information will be available. Also, our client education conference calls, like the one we're on today, are also available online. Some of the new things that are coming is, for instance, our book, The Pocket Guide to Trust and Estates, is soon going to be available in ebook format, and you'll be able to access that on our website as well. So we hope you'll take a few minutes and look at our webpage. If you have family, friends, colleagues, or clients who could use a complimentary estate planning review, we hope you will direct them to that website so they can see more information about our firm, or you can simply have them call us at 866-230-2206. So our next speaker this morning is going to be Sean Shepherd. He's attorney and partner with the firm, as Jolene mentioned earlier, and as she said, his relationship began much more than a decade ago. Sean has extensive trial experience, having handled hundreds of contested trials before judges and juries. In addition to his trial experience, he's personally handled over 60 appeals, including appeals before the Florida Supreme Court. He received his JD from Nova Southeastern University, and then he spent 4.5 years as Judge Advocate General in the U.S. Navy. He is admitted to practice law in Florida and New York and is authorized to practice before all U.S. federal district courts within the state of Florida. So I'll turn the presentation over to Sean so he can share more about the Anderson Firm's new practice areas. Sean?
Thank you, Angela. Good morning, everyone. I'm a full-time litigation attorney with the Anderson Firm. I don't practice in the area of estate planning and transactional work. I handle exclusively matters that go to court and contested matters in the estate planning and trust planning arena, as well as other civil litigation. But one of the great benefits we have here at the Anderson Firm, and Bill was a strong believer in as well, was affording our clients the benefits of not only being a transactional firm that does simply estate planning and docket preparation, document preparation, but also have the benefit of seeing that things could go wrong, recognizing that there are good and bad parts of estate and trust planning, and seeing where things could go wrong and recognizing problems before they happen, and planning accordingly to make sure that those problems are avoided in the future for our clients. There are some estate and trust planning firms that purely do transactional work. Bill was a strong believer, and I'm a strong believer, in not practicing purely in the area of transaction, but having the benefit for our clients of practicing in the area of litigation as well, to bring both of those fronts for the benefit of our client to avoid issues for our clients. Fortunately, I work day-to-day with our estate planning team here at the Anderson firm to recognize those issues and avoid problems. Our clients have the benefit of a firm that practices both transactionally and in litigation. Our goal here at the Anderson firm is to ensure that our clients have an estate plan and trust plan that goes off without a hitch, that your estate and trust planning documents are administered smoothly and seamlessly. However, that doesn't always happen on its own. With every client, we strive to prepare a plan, and we try to carry out each client's goals without any problems. And one of the biggest assets we have here is recognizing when problems exist and counseling our clients to avoid problems in the future. Litigation is a very costly thing to go through, and if anybody's had the unfortunate circumstance to go through it, they understand what I mean. And one of the greatest goals we have here and Bill believed in was avoiding litigation at all costs, to have a transactional plan that goes off without any problems, to ensure that you have peace of mind, that everything you want to benefit your family is going to go forward without having any issues. Of course, not everyone, you know, has the benefit of closing with the Anderson firm on their estate and trust plan, and we do handle litigation matters on a daily basis, and that's what I do within the firm, in addition to working with the transactional attorneys here. And we have litigation that goes on with regard to trust and estate plans prepared by other firms that were prepared poorly. Procedurally, the preparation of estate and trust planning documents is filled with landmines. There's ongoing litigation over documents prepared improperly. And I'll talk to you later on in the segment here about some of the things we can do to help prevent problems in the future by having your work done here at the Anderson firm. We handle litigation to the extent that there are beneficiaries of any trusts or estates out there who have been wronged by other people. We bring causes of action for undue influence and lack of capacity in the event that estate plans are prepared too late in life. And we also handle the big long word, tortious interference with testamentary expectancy. And those are actions against people who have caused loved ones to change their estate plan to benefit themselves and to eliminate beneficiaries and the rest of the family. So these are some of the things that I work on a daily basis, and it brings a great benefit, I think, to the firm and the transactional side, that we have the litigation side to complement that. At this time, I'm gonna turn it over to Jolene Searles, who's going to talk to you more about the 2017 tax update, and I'll be back later to talk to you about some of the preventative measures we take at the Anderson firm to help everyone. Jolene?
Thanks so much, Sean. So one thing we try to keep an eye on every year is to see what the tax laws are doing and what changes have happened. So each year we see some things will change and some things remain the same. So I just wanted to take a few minutes to point out some recent tax changes that may be of interest to everyone. As we know, during our life and upon our death, we have a lifetime exemption amount. And this is the amount that we can pass away either while we're alive or upon our death without being hit by any gift or estate tax. And that number jumped up this year to $5.49 million. So we're almost right at $5.5 million. And, of course, that's per person. Our annual exclusion, this is the amount that we can gift every year. So, for example, if I decided I wanted to make gifts to everyone on this phone call, I could write you all a check for up to $14,000 without having to report anything to the IRS or pay any taxes or do anything on that. If I were to go over that $14,000, then I would dip into that $5.49 million exemption amount. That annual exclusion, it's indexed for inflation, so usually we see it change every few years. It's been at 14 for a few years now, so I think it's very likely that in the next year or two we'll see it get bumped up. One thing that we want to be very cautious of is the income tax related to trusts. So for those of you who have a revocable living trust, you know that that's taxed just under your income tax return. So it's taxed at whatever tax bracket you're at. But upon your death, your revocable trust becomes irrevocable. And at that point, it is its own separate taxpayer. And with trust tax income, just like we step up into different income tax brackets as our income hits higher thresholds, a trust does the same. But a trust income tax brackets are much more condensed, so they jump up faster. So we always want to watch that because the trust hits the highest tax bracket once it has $12,500 of income. So for anyone who is a beneficiary of an irrevocable trust, that's something that we want to look at and potentially pull the income out before the end of the year so that we pay tax at our income tax rates instead of at the trust tax rates. And again, this is where you'll work with us, you'll work with your financial advisors, your CPAs, and we can look at that to make sure that you're not paying any unnecessary taxes. The amount that you can gift to a spouse. Now, we know that if we're married and both of us are U.S. citizens, we can give as much as we want to our spouses. So if I'm married and I want to give my husband $100 million, I can write him a check for $100 million, and I don't have to do anything. I don't have to file anything. I don't have to report anything. I'm able to do that. But if my spouse is not a U.S. citizen, I'm limited to $149,000 a year. So if I'm gifting to him, I want to be careful that I don't go over that amount because otherwise, again, I'm chipping away at that $5.49 million lifetime exemption. Something to consider with this also is jointly titling assets. So if I am married to a non-citizen and I decide to buy a piece of property and I pay for the piece of property but I put his name on there as a joint owner, that's considered me making a gift. So we always advise if any of our clients are not citizens or their spouse is not a U.S. citizen and you're looking at doing things or transferring property between each other, just give us a call and we can talk with you about it and just make sure that you're not going to cause any unintended tax consequences. We also see a lot of people that receive inheritance from outside the U.S. Whether it's a gift, whether it's inheritance you get, somebody, a relative from overseas decides to leave you some money. Anything over $100,000, you have to report. It's not that you're paying taxes on it, but you do have to report it. So that's where our number is this year. The only other one I wanted to point out was the foreign earned income exclusion. It's like a tongue twister. And this is for U.S. citizens that are living and working overseas, and they're paying taxes overseas. They can earn up to $102,100 free of U.S. tax. They just need to make sure that they do the correct reporting of that. So that is your tax update for 2017, and we'll look forward to seeing what new developments we have to report back in 2018. But in addition to some of these changes in federal taxes, we've seen a lot of states that have had some interesting changes. So I'm going to turn things over to Will to talk to you about the changes in the state tax laws.
Thanks, Jolene. Good morning, everyone. Today, as Jolene said, there's a change to the federal taxes every year, but there's also some state tax changes that we need to take note of. Maryland, for instance, has increased their estate tax exemption to $3 million. Minnesota's increased theirs to $1.8 million. And then Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, Rhode Island, and Washington, they adjust theirs for inflation each year. But the ones I really want to spend some time on with you this morning are for New York and New Jersey. For New Jersey, they used to have the worst state tax on a state level of anywhere in the country, with anything over $675,000 being taxable. And in addition to that, they have an inheritance tax. But then there was a man named David Tepper, and he was a hedge fund manager worth billions. And to avoid the estate tax, he moved to Florida, which impacted the state's tax revenue so drastically that they eventually repealed their estate tax. Now, for this year, it's gone up to $2 million, and it is set to be phased out by 2018. Now, will say that they are keeping their inheritance tax. But that doesn't affect you if you are passing assets to your children, people in your bloodline. However, a lot of people say, well, why should I get married? Well, in New Jersey, this is a very good reason if you if you're just living with your partner. If they are, according to the government, not your spouse, then you will owe inheritance taxes at a rate of 16% for anything you pass to them. And then second, for New York, New York has increased their estate tax exemption to $5.25 million, and that's scheduled to meet the federal rate by 2019. But New York's got something interesting. It's called the tax cliff, and basically what it sounds like. Once you reach a certain point, you fall off of the edge of the cliff. So what does that mean? Well, once you go 105% over that $5.25 million, you are taxed back from dollar one all the way up to whatever your estate is. So we really may need to do some extra tax planning. For that reason, I often see people who have a worse state estate tax issue than they do federally. And also in New York, there's no portability. And if you recall, portability is when you can use your spouse's exemption amount. Well, that's not so in New York. So there are certain things that we need to look at and be sure that we plan accordingly for. So with that, I'm going to send it back over to Jolene to discuss the changes in our nuclear bomb of estate planning, the intentionally defective grantor trust. Jolene?
Thanks so much, Will. So what I wanted to do was to take a couple minutes and talk to you all about the changes to the proposed 2704 regs. There's been a lot of discussion over the past year about the proposed 2704 regs published by the Treasury. These regs are what enable us to discount the values of interest in closely held businesses, such as limited liability companies, limited liability partnerships, so on and so forth. These discounts will play a big part in gifting interests and family LLCs or sales to intentionally defective grantor trusts. So it's something that has kind of got people up in arms. A lot of people enjoy and utilize gifting as a great way to reduce your estate, and you can watch the beneficiaries enjoy your gifts. The intentionally defective grantor trust is really kind of the great white whale of estate planning. It's a way to transfer significant value outside of your estate using very little of your lifetime exemption while still overseeing the management of those assets and setting up an income stream back to yourself to cover any and all of your needs. So for years, the IRS and multiple administrations have been looking to try to limit or eliminate these discounts. In September of last year, the Treasury came out with these new proposed regs. And there was a lot of concern, a lot of speculation as to what the regs would do. When looking at them, they seemed to essentially eliminate the discounts for minority interest and restrictions on transferability. So we looked at these regs. After the proposed regs come out, you have a comment period. And during that comment period, they got about 10,000 comments submitted by people in favor of and people opposed to the proposed regs. And from what I've heard, the vast majority of people and comments that were received were opposed to the regs. Then there was a hearing on December 1st that lasted for quite a while, and I spoke with one of the attorneys who testified at that hearing, and he said of all the people that testified, only one person spoke in favor of the regs. All the others were opposed to the regs. So after all that and after realizing, you know, what they were up against, the Treasury backed down a little bit, and they kind of went back to the drawing board with those regs. We don't know exactly what's going to happen, what changes will be made, when the new regs are going to be expected to be implemented, but we do now know that they won't completely eliminate the discounts, although they will restrict them. We also know that when they're implemented, they won't be done retroactively. So those of you who have done gifting using discounted LLC values, or those of you who have set up those intentionally defective grantor trusts and done those sales, we know that you don't have to worry about anything that you've done. Although there's still a lot of uncertainty in this area, we are encouraging any of our clients that have been considering doing this, whether it's doing the gifting or doing the intentionally defective grantor trust, take advantage of it sooner than later. A lot of these techniques do take a while to come into effect, and we just want to make sure that we're not kind of up against the wire when we do them. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Will to talk about some fun, interesting stories of famous people's estate plans gone wrong. All right, Will.
Thanks, Jolene. So to lighten things up a little bit, you know, we can talk about some people that we all are familiar with who have made mistakes in estate planning and what we can learn from them. And as you all know, Prince, the Purple Rain singer, passed away last year, and it turned out that Prince was evidently a very controlling guy, and I'm sure that everyone knows someone like this who couldn't imagine a world that he wasn't a part of. And so for that reason, he never did any planning whatsoever. Well, for Prince, he had a $300 million estate. So now a Minnesota judge is deciding how his assets should be distributed. And so they will be going to six siblings, but other potential heirs have crawled out of the woodwork, including a federal inmate who claims to be Prince's son. And all of this could have been avoided if he had just made an estate plan, and that's not to even get into the estate tax that'll be due on that estate. And then Whitney Houston, she actually had a will when she passed away, but it was made a month before the birth of her child in 1993, and she never touched it again. And it's an easy mistake to make, you know, to never revise it again. It's not something that we all wake up in the morning thinking about. But for Whitney, she had it set up that her daughter was to receive 10% of the estate, which ended up being $2 million as soon as she turned 21, the rest later. Well, for a kid at the age 21, and I don't know about you all, but I'm very glad that nobody dropped a big sack of money in my lap at age 21. I would surely not have done the right things with it. But by creating a trust, you can always dictate how your heirs are going to receive that money, and we make sure that they will handle it responsibly. But unfortunately, Whitney never changed her planning, and so whether her daughter's mature enough to handle it or not, she received the money. And then we all remember Sopranos star James Gandolfini. Well, James, he did start planning, but he never finished. He did have a basic will that he created in preparation for a vacation he was taking. But James had a $70 million estate when he died in 2013, and because he didn't use any sort of tax planning, his estate taxes between federal and state reached 55%. And that was a very avoidable mistake, but because he didn't think of it, he didn't utilize it, his heirs lost more money to the government than they received. And then Michael Jackson. We all remember when Michael Jackson passed away in 2009, and his estate was worth $600 million. And this is probably the mistake that 97% of the time when a trust fails, this is the reason why. He never funded it. So Michael created the trust, but he never retitled the assets into the name of the trust. So because of that, all of Jackson's beneficiaries have been in probate court over the last several years. The estate is still open to this day, and everything that ever happens to it will be subject to court approval. And that's a shame because he created the documents. He just never finished the planning. So Philip Seymour Hoffman, we all remember him from Capote and other incredible movies. That he was concerned about creating spoiled trust fund kids. And it's something that we fight against daily, but for that reason, he didn't want to create a trust. So when he passed away, his entire $35 million estate went to the mother of his kids. And that's not so bad, but his estate has a massive estate tax bill, and he isn't going to have any control over how that's passed down to his children. And there's so many ways that he could have ensured that he didn't turn them into spoiled trust fund kids just by using different provisions in the trust. He could have required that the children work, or he could have said, I will match the salary that you're making. There's lots of ways and lots of options that you can keep the kids from becoming spoiled trust fund kids. So finally, we all remember FloJo, the Florence Joyner, the Olympic gold medalist. Well, she did have a will, but no one could find it. So, you know, at the end of the day, all the planning in the world is great, but if we don't know where the documents are and nobody can come up with a copy of them, it's a moot point. So that's why we always say keep these in a place where they're accessible. If you're going to put them in a safe, then be sure that someone has the combination to that safe, because at the end of the day, if we can't get to the documents, then it can make things much more difficult than they need to be. And so with that, I'd like to turn it over to Aaron Turner, who is our Director of South Florida Operations, a 15-year veteran of the firm, and an all-around lovely person. So, Aaron?
Thanks, Will. Thanks for that glowing introduction. I'm here today to speak with you all for a few minutes on the topic of updating the estate plan. So a couple of statistics first before I jump into the meat of the subject here. I just found these interesting, and I was doing some reading online the other day, and I found that on average, only about 10% of the U.S. population has done proper estate planning. And when I say proper estate planning, I'm referring to having some documents, whether it's a will or a trust. But also in that category is ensuring that those will or trusts are actually updated. And so the second statistic I found interesting was that on average, those Americans that have done estate planning have not updated their estate plan in 15 years. And so one could imagine that 15 years down the road, the documents that a person may have in place may not accomplish the same goals. They may not even have the same goals as they had when they originally drafted that estate plan. Will mentioned Whitney Houston just a few minutes ago, and I think that's a prime example of someone who had started to do an estate plan but had not followed through and updated as their life situation changes. So, you know, at the Anderson firm, we always say that this is not a one-and-done deal. We're not a one-night stand, as Bill used to like to make the comment. It's an ongoing relationship through a person's lifetime. So as a person's financial situation, family situation, and life situation changes, it may necessitate a need to update the estate plan. So I have a list, and these are just a few of the things that would cause a need to pull out the estate planning documents and give them a review to see if this life event has in any way affected those documents. And this is not a complete list. This is just a quick list I put together for the most common occurrences that would cause the need for an update to the estate plan. And the first one on the list is a marriage. Now, obviously, a marriage for the individual who has their estate plan would require change, but a marriage within the family, if one of your children or grandchildren gets married and we have a new spouse, it may be important to go back and at least revisit your estate plan to see if we want to update this life event for that child or grandchild. The second item on the list there is the divorce. Obviously, if a couple is married and has done their estate planning together, the surviving spouse is typically in the position as trustee and healthcare surrogate and personal representative for the estate. And if there is a subsequent divorce, then we want to go back and redraft the estate planning documents for both spouses to account for the fact that they're no longer a married couple. remarriage would be the next topic there. If a person had been divorced and then is remarried and never updated their estate planning documents, that could cause a pretty serious conflict if and when the document refers to the spouse as the individual who was supposed to serve in certain roles. Obviously, we don't want the ex-spouse to serve in those roles. We want the new spouse more than likely to serve in those roles. Number four on the list of life changes is children. If we have children or grandchildren, new additions to the family, then it is important to go back through the estate planning document for review to make sure that we can account for those children or grandchildren to include them in the list of beneficiaries. Number five on the list is illness or injury. With the advances in medical science and the lifespan of people extending, and we see many times people living well into their 80s, 90s, and beyond, the time period for a disability, this is mental disability, is greatly extended. So we want to make sure that your estate planning documents account for this period, this possible period, I guess I should say, of mental disability. We're still alive and physically well, but obviously due to old age or illness or an injury, we're not mentally capable to continue to manage our financial affairs. Our estate planning documents, if done properly, really are just a set of instructions to those people that we've designated as our trustees and healthcare surrogates to take care of us in the manner that we wish to be taken care of. So we're still a beneficiary of our wills and trusts. We're just not the trustee, per se, in the event of some injury or illness. Number six, and one of the primary purposes we're all on the call this morning, is the changes in tax laws. So this would be an outside event that isn't a marriage or a new addition to the family, but the tax laws change, and that could require an update to your all's estate planning documents. And so that's, again, one of the purposes of this call, but it's something we need to pay attention to. Number seven is an inheritance. So if, instead of planning our estates for leaving assets down to our beneficiaries, that could be drastically augmented if we receive an inheritance to our estate. And so how are we going to best manage those assets and be a good steward of that money? At the same time, use and enjoy the money before passing it down to the next generation. And the last one on my short list of life changes, insurance. And so, we always talk about the needs and the uses of insurance. And so in the beginning of life stages, insurance is primarily there, typically as income replacement. If one of the spouses passed away and they were the breadwinner for the family, the insurance death benefit is there to provide for the surviving members of the family due to the loss of the breadwinner. But as we go through life and begin to compile and amass our assets, insurance can be used in many other ways, either through estate planning, sophisticated techniques that we use, or as part of an estate liquidity plan, or to insure against estate tax liability. As we move along the timeline of life, it's also important to go back and review our life insurance policies to make sure that we have proper beneficiary designation and that the product that we have in place still accomplishes the goal that exists. So again, that was not a complete list. It was a short list of life changes. We do these conference calls once a year, but feel free to reach out at any point during the year if some life event has occurred and you want to review and possibly update your estate plan. So with that, I'm going to turn it over back over to Sean Shepard, who is going to talk to you about avoiding estate litigation. Sean?
Thank you, Aaron. I spoke to you earlier all about recognizing issues and avoiding problems, and that's one of our goals here at the Anderson Firm when we prepare an estate plan and a trust plan for our clients. But you do have to stay diligent with your estate and your trust plan, as Will said and Aaron said. You have to see where you're exposed and get yourself protected, and this is an ongoing process. This is not a one-time process, and you get an umbrella and you're protected for the rest of your life. You may have your assets change. You may have your assets remain identical year after year, but the law may have changed. Or maybe your capacity is changing, and preventative measures and affirmative measures can be taken to avoid exposure under all these circumstances. As a litigation attorney, you have to recognize that one of the exposures you have in planning is the potential for future incapacity. And this could shorten our window very acutely, very quickly, or it can be an issue that we know might be coming in the future that may come gradually, but it's very important to recognize when those issues exist. A lot of the litigation that comes from people who have memory issues, memory disorder, Alzheimer's, and dementia issues, and trying to get estate planning done while those issues are being dealt with proves to be a real problem. So, again, recognizing issues and avoiding problems is the best way to approach this. And if you do have any of those issues in your family genetics, or if you have any of those issues of a very mild nature, your window of getting these things accomplished can be shortened drastically. Planning is essential, and as a litigation attorney, I look at all these estate plans and trusts that are prepared by other firms, and when I try to see weaknesses in the plan, and a client comes to me and says their child has, you know, been cut out of a will, or their friend has been cut out of a will and they want to find a way to attack a will, that's what I do for a living. So the benefit comes to the firm from what I do in recognizing those issues and trying to be preventative in preparing an estate plan and a trust plan to avoid these issues in the future. I look and see whether the documents were prepared and signed properly. And a big issue, as Will touched on and as Aaron touched on, is the trust funded. It's a huge issue. You know, we go through all this expense and time in preparing a trust, and I know we bother you at the Anderson firm about funding your plan, but it's one of the biggest issues in planning is getting all this work done but not actually titling assets and funding the plan properly. It has to be funded in order to work properly, so be vigilant about that. And the majority of the litigation in these issues comes from undue influence and lack of capacity issues, and there's a million questions that come from this topic, and we have the Q&A session. I'm happy to answer questions about it, but did the person who signed these documents have capacity when they signed them? And they'll look to everything from, you know, family interviews with people to anybody attacking a will or an estate plan on the basis of lack of capacity. They'll look to medical records and see whether a person has any issues that would interfere with their ability to have capacity to sign what they did. Those are the issues that come up when a plan is contested in litigation, and these are things that we want to recognize, as I said, and avoid and take preventative measures to stop. There are many different things that can be done. Even when a client has issues of memory loss, memory disorder, Alzheimer's, or even early onset dementia, there are changes that still can be made depending upon the circumstance of the plan. We can take videotapes and interviews of the person who's providing the plan in order to demonstrate as evidence later that the person knew what they were doing, that they intended to do it, that they had capacity. We can get affidavits from physicians and doctors. So there are many different preventative methods we can use to sort of fortify the plan and make sure that if it is going to be attacked later, that it will survive the attack and carry out your intentions as the grantor. So those are some of the issues that are present on the litigation front that we can help with and take preventative measures at the Anderson firm in preparing your estate plan and your trust plan. And I'm going to pass it back to Aaron at this point. He's going to talk to you about disability and death events. Aaron?
And thanks, Sean. And that's a really interesting topic for those of us on the call. You know, the estate planning litigation area, as we said numerous times, is one of the primary goals is to avoid when doing estate planning. But at the same time, if somebody is going to challenge a trust, they have the legal right to do so. So with having updated and augmented our litigation department with Sean Shepard at the helm, we are in the best position to ward off against any attack that might come from some disgruntled beneficiary. And that leads into my subject, which is essentially a list on how do we settle an estate. So as many of you all know, we have large estate planning binders that are tabbed with, you know, 150 pages of legalese in there, what I would call a sophisticated estate planning document. But then the simple question usually comes up, well, what happens when I get bumped on the head, or what happens when I pass away? You know, the document can be as sophisticated and as complicated as the best attorneys in the world could draft it, but it does not magically grow arms and legs after a person passes away, and then, you know, this book run around and do all the things that need to be done. So there are several steps to settling an estate that we have, and we would obviously have different steps for each individual estate, as they're all highly specific and customized for that individual and family. But I'm going to go over with you this morning some of the basic steps to settling an estate. And so the first one on the list, this is number one, big, bold number one, is pick up the phone and call the Anderson firm. So as many of you all know, our phone numbers are all over those documents, on the business cards. Angela mentioned our new website this morning, but for surviving spouses and successor trustees, really the first step in settling a loved one's estate is to pick up the phone and call the law firm. We will then provide a specific checklist on the items that need to be completed to transfer the assets over to the beneficiaries. And so one of those items that needs to be completed on any estate settlement is to get copies of the death certificate. And so we need seven copies. That's two long form versions, which include the cause of death, and then five short form versions, which does not state the cause of death on the death certificate. Number two is to locate the decedent's estate planning portfolio. So again, we've got these large three-ring binders with lots of legal documents in there. We need to get our hands on those legal documents so we can review them and follow the instructions contained therein on how to settle the estate. Number four, that's number three, going along with the documentation with the estate planning portfolio, we also want to get copies of bills, funeral expenses, medical expenses, the last expenses the person incurred before they passed away. We also want to get copies of the most recent bank statements and account statements for financial assets, copies of deeds for real estate, and anything that really shows a title for an asset that would be part of the decedent's estate. So that's an important step in the process, because how that asset was titled upon the person's death is going to determine the steps that need to be taken to transfer that asset to the beneficiaries. We also want to see if they have any safe deposit boxes or home safes, and getting combination and access to those safes is an important piece. A lot of times I'll see clients that have done good estate planning documents, but then they have squirreled them away or locked them up in a safe, and unfortunately it's more difficult for the surviving spouse or the successor trustee to access those documents. And many times we will see that the surviving spouse is just certain that their deceased spouse had done an estate plan or had a will, but they just can't find it. And so we're in a situation then where we've got to revert back to the courts to give us guidance on how to proceed forward in the event of a lost or misplaced estate planning document. We also want to make sure we secure real estate. When a person passes away, it's important to marshal the assets and make sure valuables are secured, cars are parked in the garage and accounted for, and we don't have grandkids or other loved ones driving around in grandfather's car, because there could be an event of liability against the estate if, God forbid, there was an accident. Changing the locks on the home is an important step as well. We want to make sure that personal property doesn't go walking out the front door mysteriously before we've had a chance to settle the estate and allocate any of those tangible personal properties to the individual that the decedent wanted them to go to. And then there's other things on the list dealing with credit cards, making sure that credit card companies are aware that this individual has died, and seeking to avoid any opportunity for some identity theft, which has become popular in recent years, notifying Social Security Administration of the person's passing away, VA benefits, clubs, memberships, all of these types of organizations that a person would have been part of need to be notified of their death. The mail is a big one. Having the mail collected or even forwarded to the trustee so that they're able to go through the mail and look for the bills, get copies of any assets coming in, any checks payable to that decedent or that estate, and then having a good accounting of how much debt or, if any, is still attached to the estate to be handled through the settlement process. And then beginning the settlement is typically a round of paperwork that needs to be filed, whether it's a probate with the probate courts, hopefully not, or a simple trust administration through the firm. It is important that each individual who's been tasked with serving as trustee knows and understands that there are certain steps that need to occur to settle a person's estate plan. Again, the book does not magically grow arms and legs and run around and do this retitling exercise for us. So it's going to be a coordination between the trustee, the law firm, the CPA, and typically the financial advisor at the various financial institutions to make sure those assets are passed the way that the deceased had intended. And so that's the end of my conversation on that topic. And I'm going to now turn it back over to Will Anderson, who's going to wrap us up. Will?
Thanks, Aaron. And I want to say thank you to everyone who joined us on this call this morning. You know, it's very nice that you spent your Thursday morning with us, and I hope that you learned something and that maybe you heard something that might pertain to you or someone you know. And if that's the case, or you think it might be the case, please don't hesitate to give us a ring, and as always, that's 866-230-2206. And all we ask is an hour and a half of your time so that we can understand the situation and we can give you the best advice based on what we talk about. As always, our internal culture is to give you the ultimate client experience. We want this to be the best experience you've ever had working with a law firm. So if there's anything that we can ever help with, please let us know, whether it's estate planning, litigation matter, real estate. We're always here. So just give us a ring and ask for Melissa Campbell to set up a meeting. With that, thank you all again. I'm going to turn it back over to Rhonda. Rhonda?
Thanks, Will. And thank you to all of our presenters this morning for all of that interesting and educational information. We are going to open our floor up for a question and answer session, but before doing that, I do want to offer a reminder to everyone that we are recording this call this morning so that we may upload it to our website so that we can maintain client confidentiality and not publish your names out there on the website. If you do want to introduce yourself before asking a question, we do ask that you just use first name only, or it's not necessary to give us a name at all. But we do want to maintain our client confidentiality and not have that published on the website in the recording. So having said that, we are now ready to open up the floor for questions. If anyone has a question to pose to any of our presenters, keep in mind we do have the call muted, so you're going to have to unmute your phone. And to do that, you will press star 6 on your phone. That will unmute you only and allow you to pose the question to one of our presenters. So again, if you have a question, go ahead and press star 6 on the keypad of your phone right now, and feel free to ask a question.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
My name is John.
Yes. Hi, John.
My name is John.
Go ahead with your question.
Okay. I have a daughter who is a lesbian, and she was legally married in Hawaii, and but her partner is not part of our estate plan with your firm, and I was wondering what issue that might produce.
Sure. So it depends on exactly how your plan is set up. And what I would recommend is if you can give us a call back and talk to Angela, she can pull up your documents and look and see how your daughter's inheritance is treated. If you've left your daughter the ability to leave it to her partner, then your daughter typically will be able to do that in her planning documents. And that's what most people do rather than naming in-laws, because God forbid something were to happen and there were to be a divorce after your passing, you don't want it set in stone that it goes to an ex-spouse. But a lot of people say that they want their kids to have the ability to name their spouses or to give them some flexibility. So if you give us a call, we can absolutely look at that and tell you what would happen and how she is incorporated, or if we need to make any tweaks to add her in, we can do that as well.
Okay, I'll give you a jingle.
And John,
perfect, thank you.
This is Sean, and I'll add on to that answer. Just in case there's any question about there, whether that's a valid marriage recognized here in a different state, if you're the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution allows for the recognition of the marriage in Hawaii as being a valid marriage for purposes of enforcement of your will here. So to the extent that the spouse of your daughter is named in your will, it is a valid marriage, even though it is a Hawaii marriage and maybe not recognized in other states, or maybe if other states don't recognize same-sex marriages, it still is, according to the full faith and credit clause, a valid marriage. So.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jolene?
Any other questions? Yeah.
Yes. Jolene, it's Marcel. Good morning.
Hey there.
Jolene, do you and Will still agree that the cowboy cocktail, as the great Bill Anderson said, called it, meaning the YBAP plus the Wyoming Post LLCs, are still the best combination for asset protection and estate planning?
Absolutely, absolutely. The YDAP is a great technique where you're able to keep control of all your assets as the manager of that LLC, but you've got them protected from everybody else, but they're still there for your benefit. So, yeah, for asset protection, absolutely, that's the best thing you can do. We also remind everybody that with that, the earlier you plan, the better. This is not something that works great if you call me up and say, hey, I ran over a bunch of children as I was driving down the road and I'm getting sued and trying to protect my assets. You want to look at asset protection before those liabilities arise.
I totally agree. Thanks to the good offices of the Anderson firm, and Aaron Turner did this for me. God, it's been 5 or 6 years ago, so I just want to tell everybody how the great work that your firm has been doing for us, Jolene and Will, and will continue to do for us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Marcel.
Hello?
Any other questions?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I have a high-end condominium in Fort Lauderdale, and my question is that I don't have it in my revocable trust entitled as such. And the question is, if I get it switched over, would it affect my homestead exemption?
No, not at all. As long as it still is your residence and you're putting it in your revocable living trust, we have those provisions already built into your trust where you still qualify for the homestead. Sometimes the state they'll ask for us to send a statement or a copy of the provision in the trust that says that the trust still qualifies. But it causes no problems at all with the homestead status.
Oh, thank you.
Sure.
This is John again.
You have to star six.
Yes, John.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Oh. What about, I know just enough of this to make myself dangerous. What about digital property like online bank accounts and email and cloud storage and social media accounts? How does that tie in with an estate plan terms of, I would think, red flags or identity theft and stuff. How do you incorporate that to protect yourself, you know, out there in cyberspace?
I can jump on that one. It really is a good question, and it's a developing area of the law. You know, the things that we keep online nowadays include what you just mentioned, bank accounts, but also things like family photos, spending history, travel history, all these sorts of things that is what a person seeking to steal your identity would need to be able to assume an identity, especially when we're looking at deceased individuals. They're the most susceptible to identity theft. The estate oftentimes struggles with fraudulent credit card charges or false bank statements coming in. So the trust does account for digital assets. There's a provision in the estate plan because they are important assets in modern society. So for the planning purposes, what I always tell the clients that I deal with is to keep a list, to keep a password list for your Facebook account, your Twitter account. If you do online banking, or if you have, you know, an iCloud storage account with photos or important documentation, because it's going to be up to the trustee, the person that you've named after you've passed away, to administer the estate, to marshal those assets, to lock down and change the password on those online banking access, to download and store the data from a cloud storage device, and to essentially just secure those assets. So each individual is different, and I've had clients that had the majority of their personal information online and they were comfortable with it, and then other clients who hadn't quite gotten there yet mentally to being online and in the public domain. And so each case is different, but the long and the short of it is, if you know what's out there and you've got passwords for those things, we need to be able to keep that safe after a person passes away.
Who should hold on to that information? I mean, for example,
you should while you're alive and well, but it needs to be kept with the estate planning documents so that after you're gone, or if you're bumped on the head and disabled, your trustee can have access to those.
But don't give it to the trustee in advance of my death?
You could, absolutely, if you trust them and are okay with them having that information. Absolutely, go ahead and give it to them.
Oh, okay.
If you're not comfortable giving it to them, or you haven't gotten around to giving it to them yet, just keep it with important documents, so when they're going to look for a healthcare power of attorney or, you know, the trust document, they say, oh, here's the password information for his digital assets. Just keep it together.
I would think at least give a copy of that to you guys, right? It'd be safe with you.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that we have client files for each individual client, and we can download and back up that information.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, thank you.
And we actually suggest that for other things as well. So most of you will remember when you do your documents, we talk about your personal property memo that you can fill out, where if you have specific things you want to go to certain people, send us a copy of that as well, because that's one of those things that tends to disappear or get lost. So we're happy to keep a copy of that, and that way if your kids call us up and say, how are things supposed to be distributed, we're able to give them a copy of that. So anything, whether it's asset information, whether it's memorial instructions, anything you want to send us, we're happy to keep a copy in our files.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Pat.
Hello there, Pat. Go ahead with your question.
We have, my husband and I have trusts, and one of the people named in the trust recently got married. And we were wondering, is there any way to protect what he would normally inherit? Because The marriage looks a little shaky already.
Hey, Pat, this is Will Anderson. And you, in the documents, any share that would be broken apart for your child is asset protected from creditors, predators, divorcing spouses. So at the end of the day, there's really not a lot of further action that you need to take unless you want to make sure that they can't appoint that trust share over to their spouse. But beyond that, really, it is protected with the planning that you've already got set up. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's one of the reasons that we leave things in trust as opposed to leaving it outright. So because you set it up that way, you've already got the plan in place.
Okay, fine. So the assets that he would receive are protected.
Yes, that's great. Exactly right.
Okay.
I could just add a little caveat to that. This is Aaron Turner speaking. They're protected so long as hi. They're protected so long as he does not, and I'm sorry, I'm assuming it's your son. It's protected so long as your child does not commingle those assets with their marital assets. So if he or she has received their inheritance, and as Will and Jolene just mentioned, it's in a trust, it's protected. But if he's the trustee and goes in and takes those assets out and then puts them into a joint bank account with his spouse and then gets divorced, that could lead to some issues. Where we've now got unprotected assets, marital assets that may be subject to division in a divorce proceeding. So it's important for beneficiaries to understand how they receive these assets and that the preferred method is to keep them in the trust share. Take as much money out as they are going to spend in the next 30 to 60 days, but the principal will remain safe if it's left in the trust.
Okay.
In addition to that, if you feel like the new spouse may potentially pressure your child down the road into commingling those assets, you can consider naming someone else to be the trustee of that particular child's trust.
Actually, it's a nephew, and he is also the executor.
Okay. Well, you know, it's something to think about. If you want to discuss it further, we could set up a separate telephone call and go through it, and I could run down the list of options that you have.
Okay, we'll do that
then. Ensure that doesn't. Good deal. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Pat.
Okay. If anyone else has questions, again, just a reminder to unmute your phone. You press *6 on the keypad.
Thank you
This is Georgia Anna, and I have. I lost my husband in February, and things are working out beautifully because of my trust, but I have a farm that is on an LLC that I have given, 10 shares to my children, but when I die, will the rest just be divided up?
Yes, Georgiana, when you pass, it passes exactly the way that your estate plan says. So your LLC, whatever the remaining ownership in that LLC that you have, is just going to pass how your trust says.
Okay, thank you.
You are welcome. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Nikki, and we have an estate plan. My husband and I have an estate plan with you. I'm wondering, we have established an LLC just last year, never giving any consideration to the thought that it should be involved in our estate plan. So I guess it's one of those things that we should be updating with you.
That is correct. The LLC membership interest should be owned by your trust, and so it would be just like another share of stock or a bond, and
some other type of financial asset that would be retitled into your trust.
Okay. We'll be getting
good. Happy to help on that. Just give us a call and we'll work through it.
Super. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Charles. I have a couple of questions, if I may.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Charles.
Before that, just want to thank you all for this call. I know it takes a lot of work to coordinate something like this, and it's great of y'all to do this. First question is regarding the IRA inheritance trust. For someone who has an IRA inheritance trust, let's say they're 70 and a half, they have to take RMDs, and they've got children and grandchildren named as beneficiaries under this trust. I need some help as far as the logistics of how to set this up. In the it's my understanding if the trust is a beneficiary, and let's say you have adult children who are 40 in their 40s and 50s, and grandchildren who are teenagers, and they're all beneficiaries of this trust. And you're taking RMDs, if you just have it set up that way where the trust itself is a Benny and then the assets are broken out later, then you've got to take the RMD based on the oldest beneficiary, which penalizes the younger beneficiaries. How do you set it up whereby, let's say you had three children and two grandchildren, do you open five different accounts? One in the with the beneficiary being each of the five people, so that each one has to, you know, you have to take out of each one their fair share based on their age. But how do you do that if the trust itself is the beneficiary for the benefit of each respective child? You see what I'm saying?
I see exactly what you're saying, Charles, and that's a fantastic question. So with the IRA inheritance trust, you'll see that the trust itself will break things up into separate shares. So say, for example, there are three kids and two grandkids, then everything would be broken up into five shares. And when that IRA went into the trust, it would go in, it would almost create five mini IRAs. And each one would be stretched out over that individual's life expectancy. So you would have a larger RMD for the 42-year-old child than you would for the 18-year-old grandchild. But one of the things that we want to make sure of is that the beneficiary designation that puts those assets into the IRA inheritance trust spells out the separate shares. So for the beneficiary designation, it might not just say the John Doe IRA inheritance trust. It'll say one-fifth to the Jack Doe trust share, one-fifth to the Jane Doe trust share, one-fifth to the Jill Doe trust share, one-fifth to the Jennifer Doe trust share, and so on and so forth. So the designation itself will break up those individual trust shares. And so, again, if we set that up for you and you want us to review your trust shares, just give us a call and we can pull that up and we can look at your beneficiary designations and make sure that they're set up exactly the way they need to.
I'm not worried about the beneficiary designation. I'm worried about the treatment of the RMD now, not at death. How do you set it up where the current required minimum distribution is taken out per individual beneficiary and not just taken out based on the oldest person under the trust?
And that's what those separate shares do. So while you're alive, the RMD is based on your life expectancy. Upon your death, that's where it goes based on the individual's life expectancy. And if everything is left in a pot trust, or if that trust isn't set up properly, then you're exactly right. It goes based on the oldest beneficiary's life expectancy. But if it's set up in those separate shares, and we have that designated on the beneficiary designation, then it separates based on each individual's life expectancy. Does
okay.
that make sense?
I, Yeah, in a way, I'm a little confused because if I did not have an IRA inheritance trust, let's just say I wanted to name a grandchild as a beneficiary.
Sure.
And they're 14 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
A lot younger than a spouse would be, obviously. And it's my understanding then, yeah, I have to go to the table, look at my age, but look at their age, and I wouldn't be required to take out as much.
No, your distributions have nothing to do with who your beneficiaries are. So your RMDs while you're alive are based solely on your life expectancy. It doesn't matter who you have named as beneficiary on your IRA. It's their ages
sure
come into
that?
Effect when you pass.
You're sure about that? Because I know you have to use different tables depending on whether you're married or not.
I am positive. For your IRA, if you are the owner of the IRA, it's based on your life expectancy. Now, there are different tables, like you said. There are some different tables that you can take advantage of if you're married or if your spouse is younger than a certain age. But that really only deals with you and your spouse. It doesn't have anything to do with future beneficiaries like grandkids.
Well, there is a table that refers to if you're dealing with a non-spouse. And as a beneficiary, and you use their age, I thought, in conjunction with your own. But anyway, I can talk to you about it offline.
Sure.
The other question I had was very quickly was regarding liability. I know you touched on a liability issue a while ago, but something I'm not familiar with, and I couldn't hear that clearly. But let's say you go out and buy an automobile, or you buy a property. Do y'all ever use tenants by the entirety, or do you not use that or prefer not to use that? Or would you rather use another thing like the LLC mentioned a moment ago for asset protection or liability protection?
Sure. Yeah, it really depends on the asset. There are some things where, some people will like tenants by the entirety because it does. As long as you have one innocent spouse, then that property is protected. But for example, it's a car and there's a car accident, but that car was driven by the wife, but it was in the husband's name, and they own a house together as tenants by the entirety. Unfortunately, since the car was in one of their names and the driver was the other one, since both of them would be liable, the tenancy by the entirety doesn't really protect them in that case. So that's one drawback to that. But it's definitely better than owning something just in your individual name. It does give some protection. If they're assets that have high liability associated with them, we may want to look at doing something like an LLC to segregate and compartmentalize that liability. But one of the things that we look at with any asset protection strategy is the first level of defense we always tell people is insurance. If you've got good insurance policies in place, if you have not a lot of liability associated with you, then you may not need to do a bunch of extreme measures. But if we do have some serious asset protection concerns, then again, we can sit down and we can look at the particular assets and say which ones are already protected, which ones do we want to use something like an LLC. Your house, for example, you can't put your house in an LLC. It causes some issues and can really not get much asset protection if you're using it for personal use. So something like that.
What about a second home, like a beach house or a condo or something?
The only issue with putting personal use property into an LLC is that you're using it for personal use. So if you put a vacation home into an LLC, in order to keep the business purpose, which is what gets it the asset protection, you have to rent it. So anytime you go stay at that beach house, you would actually need to pay rent to the LLC.
Mm-hmm.
If you had family members that use it, they would have to pay rent. And that would keep it with that business purpose where you can get the protection. If you go up there and you just use it for your own use, and I'll defer to Sean on this if he wants to add to it, because I know litigation is more his forte. But if you use it for your own use and they want to break into that LLC, all they have to do is show that you're using it for personal reasons. You weren't treating it as a business, and they'll be able to break right in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is Sean. Piercing the corporate veil, so to speak, and it applies to LLCs and any other entity as well. If anybody wants to prove that the assets in the LLC or the assets in the company are collectible on a personal debt, all they have to do is demonstrate that you're using it as your personal residence for your personal use, and that's not limited to just the LLC. So you got to be real careful with commingling there. Also, you know, insurance, not to be too elementary about this, but for those of you who have $100,000 and $300,000 in coverage, if you make a 5-minute phone call and ask about $1 million, $3 million in coverage, you'll be shocked at how cheap the difference is in the expense of that insurance. I did the same thing years ago, and I'm happy I did. Mm-hmm. It was only $9 more a month to have $1 million, $3 million, as opposed to $100,000, $300,000 in coverage. And at the same time you do that, you can also get a matching policy for uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, because for most of us, the most dangerous thing we do is drive a car on both ends. So if you get hit, 9 times out of 10, the other car has $10,000 in coverage for bodily injury, and you're in a real bad spot if you don't have underinsured or underinsured motorist coverage. So if you are carrying $100,000, $300,000, and you want to make a call, it's very cheap to get up to $1 million, $3 million if your insurance company offers it. So look into that.
Umbrella, you're speaking of, right? Umbrella coverage.
No, it's liability. Not even an umbrella. Under liability coverage, if you call your insurance company and you have, you know, some people only carry $10,000, that's all you're required to carry, but if you're carrying $100,000 and $300,000 in coverage, which is not a lot if you hit somebody and really hurt them, the cost of going from that level to $1 million, $3 million is a few bucks a month. It's nothing, because statistically, most car insurance settlement cases settle for less than $100,000. It's only a small percentage that settle for more than that. So statistically, the insurance companies only charge you a few more dollars to get up to $1 million, $3 million in coverage, and you'll be a lot better protected.
You're speaking now of automobile coverage, not an umbrella policy.
Just automobile coverage. You could certainly get an umbrella policy as well, but for the cost of it, it's worth comparing to, because for the automobile insurance coverage, it, again, is the most dangerous thing you do.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the cost of that additional $900,000 in coverage, it's really cheap. So
sounds like. Yeah, I have not looked into that part.
Yeah, make a call. You'll be shocked.
Thank you for that suggestion.
And one last comment on that subject, you know, when we talk about the automobile versus, you know, a slip and fall on a property, Jolene mentioned that having a personal use property as your, you know, either your primary residence or a secondary vacation home is not going to get any asset protection by putting it in an LLC. But there are types of trusts that we're able to create that would hold personal use real estate in it and be afforded a high level of asset protection. So it's really going to depend on where the liability comes from. It's going to equal the results depending on the type of structure that asset is in. So LLCs work for many different types of assets, but also irrevocable trusts can be created that will protect the assets that the LLC won't protect.
Great point, Aaron.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Anyone else that has questions? As a reminder, if you're still on mute, you will need to hit *6 on your phone to unmute. No more questions? Well, if we have no more questions this morning, I would like to once again thank everyone for joining us this morning for this call. This is something we do once a year. So until next year when we have this presentation again, if you do have any questions, if you have updates that need to be done, new planning, or friends, family that might need assistance, please feel free to give us a call. We are certainly here to help in any way that we can. And thank you once again. Goodbye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.